Good morning, and thank you for coming out on what I hope is the last snowstorm of the Washington spring. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Jim Lewis. I'm joined by a number of my colleagues and some distinguished visitors. Sherman Katz and I are the co-hosts of this event. Let me start with a story, which is that the Department of Treasury and the Department of Commerce sent a report to the president, and they said that a powerful new economy had emerged, and it would dominate world trade and finance. It would exclude American products and gradually take over global markets. So this is, of course, a cause for concern, but actually that was 1970, and Treasury and Commerce were writing about the European Union. So this isn't the first time we've faced issues like this. You know, the interesting thing was, if you look at the response back then to this and a number of other globalizing indicators, it was to impose a 10% surcharge on imports, cut foreign aid, impose domestic price controls, and suspend convertibility of the dollar. So it's interesting that in the debate we're having now, the public debate, no one is really talking about measures like this. A whole set of measures has been moved off the table. And in some ways you could say that's a positive thing, that people are more comfortable with the ideas of trade and technology and free trade and globalization. But it's not an unalloyed blessing, and we're going to face a messy period of adjustment, as we have faced messy periods in previous episodes. The real issue for me isn't really jobs or outsourcing, but competition and economic growth. And these are things where we as a nation and all nations are going to face more intense competition and have a more difficult time finding a good path towards economic growth in the face of that competition, global competition. This is actually the confluence of two series. Sherman and The Economist are doing one. CSIS is also doing another set of series of meetings looking at globalization, at innovation, and what a national response should be. In your packet, there's a one-page description of this. There will be five sessions that look at various topics. Our goal is to help provide insight and information for the debate during this period of transition. So what we're going to do today is Sherman will talk next, and then we'll go to our speakers. Congressman Smith has been delayed by a vote. I know that comes as a shock to all of you who live here in Washington, but he will be here probably in about half an hour, we're told. So Sherman, please.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks again for being here. We have a distinguished group of both current and former public servants who have a variety of perspectives to bring on the issues related to global economic forces affecting the United States, including outsourcing, and we're delighted that they've been able to make their time available. Outsourcing, of course, as you know, is just one of these many forces. I suspect more ink has been spilled on this subject in the last few weeks than any subject I've had an opportunity to address in the 3 years I've been here. So I'm going to try to be very brief and put this in the hands of the experts we have today. We want to discuss some of the facts, some of the causes, and some of the policy reforms that have been suggested around this topic. Some of the facts are, is this a large phenomenon or is it a small phenomenon? Indeed, it's difficult to agree on policy responses if you can't get agreement on the dimensions of the task. And Congressman Smith, who will join us later, is, as you know, one of the congresspeople who initially asked the General Accounting Office to undertake an investigation, which is now underway, in order to determine the underlying facts. Is this outsourcing as part of globalization, is it a strength or is it a weakness? It has costs and it has benefits. Do the benefits outweigh the costs or is it the other way? There's been lots of discussion about what the causes are, and we look forward to remarks from our panelists. Is this a function of the business cycle? Is it a function of productivity growth? Is it because our competitors, particularly in India and China, as Charlene Barshefsky put it, are getting smarter above the neck? Is it because of the management of the Fed, which has seems to have slain the inflation dragon for the time being, but that in turn has made it difficult for businesses to raise prices? So rather than raise prices, they are trying to cut costs. Then what should the responses be? As we all know, there have been a number of restrictive proposals, trade restrictive. There's some talk about expanding adjustment assistance. There's some talk about improving our competitive environment here at home. There's some talk about asking our friends in India and elsewhere to do a little more for us since we're doing as much as we are for them. And, of course, we'll try to look a little bit at what some of the results of our relations with these other countries might be were we to adopt any of these responses. Justin Hendricks is here from The Economist, and we're delighted to have their help and participation. Justin, would you like to say a word of welcome?
Sherman, I won't take your time. The Economist was, as you know, founded in 1843 to support the cause of free trade. At the time, it was the Corn Laws in Britain. Protectionism, well, the Corn Laws themselves sort of disappeared in 1846, but protectionism itself still rears its head from time to time, so we're still in business. And we're very proud of this relationship with CSIS and of the programs that Sherman's put on. We hope that you'll enjoy this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Chris, do you want to introduce our first speaker?
Sure. We're going to do tag team introductions, so it will keep you awake, I hope. Our next speaker is Bill Sweeney, who is the Vice President of EDS Global Government Affairs, and he is responsible for managing EDS's relations with governments and policy organizations in literally dozens of countries, but he's particularly well-known here in Washington, where he's one of the central figures in thinking about business and economic issues and involved in many, many activities, and is, of course, someone who has been very helpful to CSIS in providing us with insight and information and understanding. So we're very pleased to open with Bill. Thank you.
Well, good morning. It's an honor for me to be on this panel. It's particularly an honor for me to be in the presence of so many distinguished American and diplomatic leaders that I've had the pleasure of working with in my role at EDS for many years. And so I will do my best to live up to the standards that so many in this audience have put before me in terms of their ability to deliver value from a podium. Let me first of all introduce EDS. EDS is an information technology company. It was founded by Ross Perot almost 40 years ago and started the business of computer services, information technology services, and, yes, outsourcing. We have 135,000 people. We have a business presence in 58 countries. We have a practice called Best Shore, which is to help our customers deliver on a global basis, 24/7, following the sun, using local talent, using local resources, and we have 15 facilities around the world, which we call Best Shore facilities. And we are expanding employment in many of those Best Shore facilities, such as New Zealand, as the ambassador and I were talking about. And that is work that is being done at our customers' direction so that they can serve their customers as we go around the world. And if anything, the world in information technology and services and delivery and telecommunications is getting smaller, not larger. Now, it's important at the start of this discussion that we understand exactly what people are so emotional about, particularly here in the United States, and I would argue that they are going to get very emotional in Europe in about a year on this topic. And that is what I call offshoring or offshore outsourcing. Outsourcing is a business discipline that hundreds of companies are involved with. They decide they can't do everything for themselves, and thus they identify functions and turn those functions over to people whose business it is to do that function exceptionally well. CSIS, great organization. The Economist, a great organization. Maybe they're not so good at janitorial services, so they outsource that function to workers to take care to a company that does it very well. Maybe they're not so great at real estate, so they outsource that function. Maybe they're not so good at information technology, so with any luck, they outsource that function to EDS. That's the business EDS is in. 135,000 people serving the public sector and the private sector around the world. Now, on the particularly emotional section called U.S. government contracts that EDS does $2 billion worth of work in for this taxpayer of the United States at the state level, the local level, and the federal level, virtually none of that work is done outside the United States. Some of that is by contract demand, because believe it or not, in business, the customer is king. And if the state of California tells us that they want all work done for the state of California within 50 miles of Sacramento by contract, then guess what? We have a data center in Sacramento, and we'll take that business, and we'll do it within 50 miles. And if you talk to state officials about offshore outsourcing, they get real parochial. For example, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, they consider it offshore outsourcing if you do work for the Commonwealth of Virginia in Maryland or North Carolina. Okay? They get very parochial. And guess what? Public officials around the world are the same way. So the work we do for the government of New Zealand, we actually do in New Zealand. And the work we do for the government for Her Majesty's government, we actually do in England. So you follow your customer. And if your customer is General Motors or ABN AMRO or Xerox or a number of other fine global companies, and they say, we want this work done under these conditions, we do that work under those conditions because the customer is king. Our best shore practice started in 1990 with the opening of the Dublin Data Center, the very beginning of what now is called the Celtic Tiger. And that was to provide, after a competition among Ireland, the Netherlands, and Belgium, calling and computing centers that could service Western Europe for one of our global customers. And so this is not a random process. This is a very disciplined, focused delivery process that looks at a number of factors. Among those factors are, number one, the demand of the customer. Number two, the type of local talent that you have available. And guess what? Many countries in the world that have been listening to the United States and the United Nations and the European Union have been investing in education, have been loosening their marketplaces and their telecommunications monopolies. And they do have local talent. And that local talent is in all of our businesses. Number three is obviously cost. Number four is productivity. Number five is political risk. Number six is infrastructure delivery. Our industry is very dependent on electric power. Our industry does not like things like earthquakes and tidal waves and hurricanes. It's very bad for computers if they get washed, you know. That doesn't do well for us. We also take a look at security. And frankly, some of the offshore outsourcing that's going on is a direct result of companies looking at their facilities and saying, we've got to have redundancy, and redundancy in the New York metropolitan area does not mean Brooklyn. You think I'm kidding. Redundancy might mean Canada. Redundancy might mean Mexico. Redundancy might mean Argentina. Same time zone. Skilled labor force. Able to back up your records. Now, two issues that are of prime importance in terms of the offshore outsourcing debate, particularly in my area, in my business, namely the information business, are number one, privacy, and number two, cybersecurity. The customer determines where his or her company's records are going to be maintained. By and large, U.S.-based customers prefer that their records be maintained in the United States, which means that our best shore facilities in Mumbai or Malaysia or New Zealand that are doing the work of that U.S.-based customer do not have the capacity to print. They do the work electronically, and the records never leave the country. We have other customers who prefer that their records be maintained in our databases in England, or our databases in Malaysia, or our databases in Australia. Again, customer is king. And we, EDS, as a company, go to the highest standard on privacy, not the lowest common denominator. So if Italy has got the highest standard, or California has the highest standard, our network goes to that standard so that we can deliver globally. That's what we do. We're in the information business, and privacy is exceptionally important to us. The other issue is security, particularly cybersecurity. And this is an area of grave concern, particularly if countries either do not have laws in this space or do not enforce their laws in this space. And this is a legitimate part of this discussion without the emotion, because this is a very important issue on a global basis. And let me speak specifically for a minute or two to U.S. concerns. EDS and many other high technology companies support extension of training benefits that have been provided under the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act to the manufacturing sector, to the service sector. We are a service economy. That's a fine bill, fine legislation. We ought to fund it and expand it, because there is real displacement going on. And there was displacement going on before this issue came along. And the service sector is larger than the manufacturing sector. And they're U.S. taxpayers, as we are. Number two, we think there should be a robust debate about immigration policy. And that debate should be looking towards the jobs with a future. And in particular in the area of H-1B visas, where EDS has about 1,000 of them, the fees that companies pay for the H-1B visas that were supposed to go to retraining programs for service sector workers should not be pocketed by underfunded retraining programs for manufacturing workers, which is a Department of Labor action that I've made some noise about. Number three, education policy. Our business is the knowledge industry. Our business needs engineers. Our business needs computer scientists. And we as a country have to continue to make an investment in those skill sets. And we have to make an investment in those skill sets in as many levels as possible. And this is a particular challenge to governors. At the National Governors Association meeting about a month ago, I was involved in a long discussion on this topic. And many of the governors would come up to you and they'd say, you know, we've been able to fund our education by protecting K through 12 and taking it out of the hide of the university system. Governor Easley in North Carolina has been particularly courageous trying to bring about full funding for vocational and community colleges, so as to get the service sector in that space, in that state, which has the research triangle and other things and has labor shortages, bring those people up to those skill levels. And finally, we've got to take a long, hard look at investment policy in this country. And the investment policy that I want to talk about is how we keep jobs. You know, if you're with a local investment authority, your success is in bringing new jobs. We've opened a new facility, 200 new jobs. Meanwhile, the old facility had to make a business investment, had to make a business decision. We're going to put a new investment here. Now, do we get maximum return by investing in this old plant or this old facility or this old calling center and upgrading that long term, or do we go someplace else where there are tax incentives, where there's this and there's that? And what happens is jobs move. Jobs move. And I think investment authorities have to take a new look at how they're spending public money so as to keep what they've got and keep their communities intact, because it is a global workforce, it is a global competition, and if anything, as we get closer and closer together, the competition is only going to become more and more intense. I had wished to follow the congressman so I could have endorsed whatever the congressman says, because that's the job of a lobbyist in public, right? But I'll look forward to that opportunity during the questions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Our next speaker is Chris Padilla, who is the Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Liaison. I've known Chris for many years, and he works now with state and local governments to help them understand trade policies, which will be very handy, I think, for today's discussion. But before that, he worked in Washington for a number of companies that really give him some valuable insights. The last was Kodak, but before that he worked for Lucent and then for AT&T. So Chris has really covered a range of issues. He's also been the chair of the U.S. China Trade, what was the name of the group?
Coalition,
involved in trade issues with China. So the background couldn't be better for our next speaker. Chris, thank you.
Thank you, Jim, and Sherm, thank you for both organizing this forum on an important and timely topic. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Jim mentioned my experience in the telecommunications industry. When I worked in that industry not all that long ago, I left the telecom industry in 1997, the thought of having instant communications by telephone or computer with far-off workers overseas was really unthinkable. Not all that long ago, calling India was like calling the moon. It cost about $2 a minute. The connections were terrible, and pretty much every other call dropped for lack of capacity on international telephone cables or satellites. And you could forget about email. You couldn't even send a two-page fax to New Delhi before the line went dead. Today, less than a decade later, the world is linked by undersea fiber optic cables and satellites that make calls from New Delhi sound like they're coming from next door. It's this advance in communications technology, combined with the fact that English has become the world's second language, that has created new competitors for America in the service industries. This new competition in the service industry is driven chiefly by technology, not by a trade agreement. The question, though, is how to respond to this new competition. I don't think anyone seriously suggests that we should run to the cable landing stations and cut off the submarine cables that link us to the world, isolating America technologically. Yet some are proposing trade measures that would be the economic equivalent of doing just that. Our economy has successfully faced the challenges of new kinds of competition before, and we've overcome those challenges by growing our economy and expanding jobs at home. In the 1960s, the new challenge was electronic automation. In the 1980s, it was competition from Japan. Each time, pessimists predicted that America's workers couldn't compete. Each time, they were wrong. Today, the new challenge is foreign competition in service industries. And there is no doubt that it is causing real and genuine concern among Americans. Let's all agree on one thing up front. We want every American who wants a job to have one, and we will not rest until that happens. Jobs not only provide for our families, they give us hope. I know from personal experience that when you, a friend, a family member, relative, loses a job, for whatever reason, it is a deeply painful experience. It doesn't matter whether the job was lost because of changing technology, out-of-state competition, or offshore competition. When someone loses a job, we need to help them get back on their feet. And we need to create more, new, and better-paying jobs. How do we do that? There are two basic paths we can follow. The defeatist path of isolating America, putting up walls and barriers, or the proven path of economic growth. The economic isolationists are shouting pretty loudly these days. Consider this pessimistic statement, quote, "With America's high standard of living, we cannot successfully compete against foreigners because of lower foreign wages." Does that sound familiar? Ring a bell to any of you? Maybe you think you heard something like this on CNN from Lou Dobbs, whose anti-immigrant, anti-trade, us-against-the-world rants are fast turning him into the Archie Bunker of the 21st century. But in fact, these words were spoken by Herbert Hoover in 1929 as he successfully urged Congress to pass the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act that raised barriers, destroyed jobs, and deepened the Depression. Today, as in the 1930s, offshore competition stirs passionate debate. But as we learned 75 years ago, isolating America from the world is not the answer. The administration believes there are several important ways that we can remake our economy to meet the challenges of a newly interconnected digital world. First and foremost, we need to open new markets for American companies to compete in the world economy so we can create jobs here at home. When we work with the world, America is economically stronger. Two-thirds of our economy is in services, and over the last 20 years, the service sector has generated 40 million new jobs and has continued to generate about 2 million new jobs a year, even during the economic downturn. On average, those service jobs pay on par with those in manufacturing. We export more than $275 billion a year in services from this country, and we've more than doubled that since 1990. We have a $60 billion trade surplus in services. But 95% of the world's customers live outside of our borders, and we need to further open foreign markets in order to get better access to those customers for our service companies and workers. America's service workers are the best in the world. As we speak here this morning, trillions of bits of information are being exported from the United States, the product of American labor. News reports, computer software, legal opinions, tax forms, bank statements, music, books, movies are all being exported today across computer networks and the Internet. As we speak, U.S. companies are flying overnight packages to customers in China. Engineers in Wichita are figuring out how to make buildings in Japan safe from earthquakes. And advertising mavens in New York are figuring out how to sell the latest fashions in London. In fact, more than 12 million Americans have jobs supported by exports of goods and services. And let's not forget that almost 6.5 million Americans also have in-source jobs, working in the United States for foreign companies. Some of them are building cars in Ohio and South Carolina. Others are performing services, like the Americans from the Dutch-owned bank in Minnesota that just refinanced my mortgage at what I might add was a very competitive rate. I benefited from an American working in an open services economy. As these examples show, Americans can compete with anyone in the world and can win. And our service market is open, but we need to be able to trade our services into other countries as well. So the heart of our trade agenda is to open new markets for American service workers. That means pushing countries like India, Brazil, China, and others to open their largely closed market for services. It means seeking improvements in the offers of many countries in the Doha round of WTO talks to go beyond the GATS commitments of the Uruguay round, not simply to reaffirm them. And it means using a so-called negative list approach to services in our bilateral trade agreements, where we liberalize all services unless a specific exception is taken. That brings me to the second part of our approach, which is to make sure that America's services get a fair chance to compete on a level playing field. We are standing up for America, being vigilant and active in enforcing our trade agreements so that American service workers get a fair shake. We just helped to open the telecommunications market in Mexico through a WTO case that will be announced later this week. And we pushed China to live up to its commitments, negotiated under the previous administration, to allow Americans to sell insurance and provide car loans. Those were important commitments, and it's important that we follow through on them. As Ambassador Zelek made very clear when he was in New Delhi last month, if India wants to have continued access to markets in the United States, then it has got to open its own very closed markets as well. Third, we need to continue cutting hidden import taxes that hurt working families the most. Our recent trade agreements have cut hidden import taxes on goods, have cleared away bureaucratic red tape affecting services, and have saved every working family in America as much as $2,000 a year. Our new trade agreements could save families more. As my friends at the Progressive Policy Institute correctly pointed out recently, arguing for trade barriers is like arguing for a tax on single working moms, because that's who pays the most in import taxes as a percentage of household income. Finally, we need to help people take charge of their economic futures and manage change, particularly when it concerns jobs. In 2002, the Congress and the President, with Congressman Smith's help, worked together in a bipartisan way to triple trade adjustment assistance in the Trade Act of 2002. Some have dismissed this program, but last year this program provided about $1.3 billion in support and retraining, with nearly 200,000 workers eligible for assistance. Senators Coleman and Baucus have recently put forward some bipartisan ideas on ways to tailor TAA to workers in the service industries. There's more. The President's Jobs for the 21st Century initiative provides $500 million in new funding for education and training, with about half that focused on partnerships with community colleges to develop worker training programs tailored to local needs of local businesses. And the private sector has an important role here, too. American companies spend about $70 billion a year on worker education and training, and they will need to expand this investment in people for the future. Today's opponents of trade, like those of the past, are pessimists who want to retreat, to cut America off from the world, to create bureaucratic rules that won't work, that will raise prices for working families, and that will never go away. We need to remember that what goes around comes around. If America closes its markets, others will close their markets to America. Economic isolationists who play on fear and criticize trade don't tell you that their policies would put tens of millions of American jobs at risk. And the human price of closing markets is larger still. Over the last decade, through trade agreements negotiated by both Republican and Democratic administrations, trade has helped to raise 140 million people out of poverty around the world, spreading prosperity and peace to places that have seen too little of both. Americans will not prosper in a world where lives of destitution lead to societies without hope. So our trade agenda is focused on four things. First, strengthening our economy by working with the world, opening new markets for American services. Second, standing up for America, enforcing our trade agreements to make sure that our workers get a fair chance to compete on a level playing field. Third, continuing to cut hidden import taxes and bureaucratic barriers that hurt working families the most. And fourth, working to remake America's economy through lower taxes, less bureaucratic interference, and better education and retraining for our workers, thus creating economic growth and new jobs. That's our vision, a vision of a world that trades in freedom, and I believe it's a vision that is worth working for. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm very pleased that we've been joined by Congressman Adam Smith. It'd be hard to come up with a better name for participant in a seminar like this. Congressman Smith has represented the 9th District of the state of Washington since 1997, and he's a lifelong resident of that district. He is a member of the House International Relations Committee, and in that capacity serves on the Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. He's also a member of the House Armed Services Committee, and he is one of two congresspersons who had the foresight in the fall of last year to ask the General Accounting Office to undertake an investigation to find out what the facts are about outsourcing. Congressman Smith, we began by saying that one of the things we desperately need in this debate is more knowledge about the facts. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'll remind everyone that we've agreed that after all the speakers, before we open the floor for questions, we'll invite the speakers to ask questions or make comments about each other's remarks. Congressman Smith.
Thank you for the opportunity. As I'm sure has been mentioned, this is a very timely conversation. Outsourcing has become one of the big buzzwords that everybody's talking about. I mean, it's on the radio, in the newspapers, in the conversation, and really it's just, at this point, it's become another word for the economy. When you're looking at what our plans are for economic growth and jobs in this country, that's what people are concerned about when they talk about outsourcing, is what is the future of our economy? Where are the jobs going to be in the future? How are we going to be able to achieve sustainable growth in this country? It's just the starting point for that discussion, and I think it's very important that we start having that conversation and figure out what the best policy approaches are, because right now it seems like that the two most dominant approaches are both going in the wrong direction, in my opinion. One is something that cropped up certainly during the Democratic presidential nomination contest and has also cropped up in other places, and that's sort of the protectionist approach, which is, you know, to bash on trade, bash on immigration in many cases. We have to hold on to everything we've got, otherwise we're not going to be able to survive. And it's ironic, I was at a press conference where someone was sort of advancing that viewpoint and complaining about some of the policies that our country has failed to adopt, and saying that, you know, in Japan, they protect their workers, and cited all the examples of how Japan had done that. And I think that's absolutely true. And as all of you know, that's why one of the big reasons Japan's been in a recession for the last 10 years, and the connection doesn't seem to dawn on too many people. It's easy to go in that frightened, we have to protect what we have route, but history shows us doesn't work. We have to come up with a better approach than that, because the capacity to change is what drives people forward. And when you lock in place numerous policies that strangle your capacity to change, which is what protectionism does, you are more likely than not going to wind up with a worse economy than when you would have had otherwise. We need to make sure we make that case. That taking this approach isn't going to help. Of course, taking this approach, as was mentioned by the previous speaker, also would amount to the largest tax increase in the history of the world, a point that needs to be made. I've had the occasion in the last several months to debate Dennis Kucinich surrogates, never the man himself, regrettably. But and, you know, that point comes up. They want to get us out of the WTO. And I point out, you know, you pull us out of the WTO and out of NAFTA, the instantaneous thing that's going to happen is taxes will go up dramatically, and the impact on people is going to be devastating. And you can't just sort of blow past that with the discussion of the problems we're having in the economy today. The fact that we have problems in the economy does not necessarily mean that that response, getting out of the WTO and bashing on trade, is going to be helpful. In fact, the facts tell us a dramatically different story. But just as bad, to some degree, is the opposite response that on occasions many people in the Bush administration have taken, and that is essentially relax. Everything's fine. This is creative destruction at work, capitalism moving forward. Everything's going to be fine. What are you people worried about? That approach is no better policy and certainly will not be greeted very well politically. There are things that we can do that are not protectionist, that are smart, that do move us forward in the right direction. Simply saying that, you know, the unfettered hand of capitalism in the free market system is going to automatically work doesn't get you there, and I will share with you my favorite Adam Smith quote. Not me. I'm not quite that vain. I don't have favorite quotes of my own. But The Economist, you know, and this, you know, he's the invisible hand. I have a lot of Republicans who are deeply disappointed when they find out I'm a Democrat. Don't imagine how that can be possible. But if you read what Adam Smith wrote, he wrote about a good deal more than just the free market. In fact, he had quite a bit in there about the problems that the free market can create and the fact that there needs to be counterbalances to some of those problems. And his quote was, whenever two or more business people gather in one place, it is to conspire against the public good. It's a bit of an overstatement, I'll grant you, but hyperbole. But the point is that we need to have some balancing factors. We can't just sort of let it float and see what happens. There are people in this country who are legitimately struggling, who are facing this competition that they never expected, and they need help in dealing with it. Certainly a cornerstone of that has to be job training. And one of the disturbing things that I've heard people talking about recently in criticisms of the TAA bill and others is, you know, we're training people for jobs that don't exist. You know, therefore, what's the point? Well, that's really not true. I don't doubt that there are instances where someone has been retrained for something and then has lost that job as well. But there are hundreds of thousands of instances where retraining and increasing your skills has made people employable and improved their lives. The idea that improving job skills is not absolutely central to what we're doing in the economy is one that I very strongly disagree with. We need education and job skills and training more than anything else if we're going to be able to compete, because the capacity to change issue that I mentioned earlier is our great strength as a nation. We have a greater capacity to change than just about any other nation that's been created for a variety of different reasons. We can get to the next best thing first, more frequently. But education and job training has to be a key component of that. And when you look around at statistics to be scared of, we hear about the trade deficit, we hear about what's going on in China and India, and there's a lot of things to be concerned about. The only thing out there that really scares me right now is when you look at the education levels in math, science, and engineering in this country and how far we have fallen and how we continue to fall. Years after we started this conversation about how important math, science, and engineering were going to be to the growth in the economy, we still have a declining number of people receiving degrees in those areas in this country. Whereas you look at China, where 70% of their undergraduate degrees are in either math, science, or engineering, in the U.S. the figure is 5%. Now that is scary. We need to reinvest our efforts here to get people to go into those areas. It starts at the K-12 level. I have a long K-12 speech, which I will spare you. But the point is, we need to make changes there. Because by the time you get to the university level, we've lost 50, 60, 70% of the students who no longer, in many cases, have any interest in school and certainly don't have any interest in math, science, and engineering. So changing our standards there, moving us more forward in those areas is critical. But job training is a key piece of it. I've got a bill right now to expand trade adjustment assistance training to service workers who have been dislocated. Anything we can do to get more money in training, I think, is critical to being able to compete and move forward. The other piece, previous speaker handled beautifully, don't really need to restate it, we need to use the trade rules to our advantage. I think, again, we've had a little bit of a laid-back approach to that, which says, you know, trade works for us, so we don't need to really push too hard on issues, whereas our competitors have been none too shy about using the rules against us. We're going through that with the FISC issue on the tax issue that the European Union came after us on. We have not responded in kind to make sure that we enforce the trade rules that are there. India should not be able to bar access by our service industries to the degree that they are. China should not be able to steal our products, which, by the way, they do routinely. And by steal them, I'm not just talking about software and intellectual property. I'm talking about actual machine-made products that they come over here, copy, remarket as their own, that we have patented here in this country, and we do nothing about it. And this is businesses large and small. I have several small businesses in my district who have shown me the products they make and shown me the products that China's now making, stealing their patent, and we have not responded to that. We need to use the rules to our advantage. But we also need to understand that opening markets is a good thing and not give in to the notion that trade is somehow bad for our economy. There are a lot of markets out there that we can access. We need to open them. Job creation is not a zero-sum game. The mere fact that jobs are being created in India and China is not bad for us here at home, and we need to get that notion out of people's minds. I mean, it's an unsustainable policy from a fairness standpoint. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of people living in abject poverty in India and China, and we're going to tell them it's a problem when they start getting jobs, finally. I don't think that's a sustainable approach, and we don't have to worry about that. If they're getting jobs, growing, they're increasing the people who we could have access to from a market standpoint if we have smart trade policy and move forward on that. I also think, and the final point I will make on tax policy, we do a lot of subsidies and tax breaks for businesses in this country, and I think that's a good thing. I'm not of the school that thinks corporations are evil. They grow the economy, create jobs, and have done a lot of positive things, and we should help those corporations and businesses that are growing our economy. What I wonder about is whether or not the tax policy that we currently have in place does that, or if it is based on previous economic models that help companies and businesses that may not be growing our economy. One example, we still subsidize fast food restaurants to open locations in urban areas. The thinking being, I guess, we want to help grow the economy in areas of the U.S. that are distressed. But, I mean, we're talking about $7, $8 an hour jobs with no benefits that on average last 3 months. That's where we want our tax dollars going, is to help create those kind of jobs. Couldn't we spend those tax dollars on some small business that's creating much better jobs, or on a business that is investing in R&D to develop new technology and in health sciences, or in energy, expanding areas where there are real opportunities? We need to be smarter about how we spend our money as a nation. And I guess the final point that I'll make, every business that I've encountered here recently has a pretty good list of ideas for things that we ought to do to sort of get us off of the protectionist bent. And most of the focus is investment in R&D, investment in education, all of these different ideas. And I think that's great. But if we're going to do that, the federal government needs some revenue, needs some money. And you can't be doing that while at the same time saying that it's a huge priority to make the president's tax cuts permanent. Or at a minimum, if you don't want to do that, if you want to put a budget down on the table that says we can make the tax cuts permanent, here's what we can cut to make up for the money that we need for these other things. That's fine, too. Personally, I don't think that can be done, but maybe I'm wrong. Someone can show me different. But to just say, here's all the places that we need to spend money, and we want our permanent tax cuts, and we're not going to tell you where to find the money, good luck. Not a real sound policy approach for us. And let me tell you, this is our problem. And by our problem, I mean all of us, not just the members of Congress. Businesses in this country, we are facing the protectionist backlash. We are facing challenges to our economy. We need to seriously step up and address these issues and not imagine that they don't affect us. We can't do that unless we address the money side of this problem. Where is it going to come from? How are we going to have enough resources to do what I think we all agree we desperately need to do to maintain our competitiveness in this country? Thank you for the chance to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Congressman Smith. Our next speaker is Lawrence Meyer. Lawrence Larry was a governor at the Federal Reserve Board from June 1996 through January 2002. At that time, we had the great fortune of having him come to CSIS, where he is now a distinguished scholar. He is an advisor of major financial firms in Europe and Asia, as well as the United States. He will publish with Harper Business in July of this year a book called A Term at the Fed, and we are all looking forward to that a great deal. Larry, we look forward to your remarks. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Sherman. It's never too early to start selling the book, so I appreciate that. Globalization is having a bad year. So began an article by Eduardo Porter in the New York Times on Saturday, and that might have been an understatement. And the anxiety about globalization is increasingly focused on outsourcing or, as Bill Sweeney suggested, offshoring might be a better way of capturing the term. And now, of course, it's become a campaign issue, so we have precious few days left to shed any insight on this before we get overwhelmed in political spin. This is a dangerous topic to talk about, I think we should all sort of appreciate. There's many who have written articles and have been quoted in the newspapers have gotten a lot of unpleasant mail about it. Greg Mankiw, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, is one of those who's found how dangerous it is to talk about this subject. And it does remind me a little bit of being at the board and one piece of mail I got after the bursting of the equity bubble. I got this postcard. And it was scribbled in pink ink, and that was kind of a sign right there. And when I turned it over, it didn't take me long to figure out this was not fan mail. The salutation was, "Dear spawn of Satan." Okay, so I hope my remarks today will not generate such mail, but you never know. Now, I think the first question we should ask is, how big is this problem? Okay, well, I hope you'll ask that question. I hope someone will answer it because I can't. We have very little data right now on that, and I hope GAO study perhaps and others will sort of fill in this hole. But I presume where there's smoke, there's fire. This is something we do need to be paying attention to. But I believe very strongly that the angst and emotion we see directed at offshoring really reflects the fact that it is getting the backlash for three things. All forms of globalization, offshoring just being the latest dimension, for the downside elements of the productivity acceleration in terms of employment growth, and for a remarkable set of cyclical forces. I it's always compared to what? That's always very important. So say, you know, what's going on in the labor market? Well, what are you going to compare it to? If you could compare it to the low point in the unemployment rate when it was 3.9%, that was, I think, quite likely and almost assuredly unsustainable, to the period of irrational exuberance that not only affected equity prices but the demand for high-tech goods and high-tech services as well. So we had overshot at that point, and now, of course, we've got a cyclical decline. We've overshot in the other direction because of the bursting of the equity bubble, post-bubble hangover, et cetera. So all these forces, cyclical, other structural, and all dimensions of globalization. I do want to start with sort of three questions. First, I want to look at different forms of globalization and productivity accelerations and ask what's the difference between those. And that'll be a way of making the positive case for offshoring as part of globalization. But it'd be a terrible mistake not to try to dig deeper and try to understand why the angst and why the anger about this issue. So I will try to do that as well. And then finally, I'll have some brief comments on public policy responses. Offshoring is the third dimension of trade-related globalization. The first is just import substitution. Americans buy goods produced abroad instead of at home. The second was migration of production. American firms move abroad to produce. Now goods that the consumers are buying in the U.S. instead of being domestically produced are imports. Again, another form of import substitution. And the third is American firms produce the goods at home, but they outsource some of the work abroad. Now, Mankiw's had two propositions about this that generated a lot of mail. The first they called the equivalence proposition. That's all these things are basically equivalent in terms of their impact on American workers and consumers. And the second they called the net benefit proposition, and that is that on average in the long run, these are positive developments that add to real incomes, raise living standards in the U.S. and around the world. And as he said, more things are tradable in the past, and that's a good thing. Now, the economics of outsourcing is very much about the positive net benefits, comparative advantage, and I'm not going to go too much more into those sort of details, but basically the availability of lower-cost products to American consumers raises living standards in the U.S. But all these things have an immediate impact on employment. Of course they do. If you buy the goods abroad instead of in the U.S., if you shift labor abroad and you migrate production, the immediate impact is to lower the demand for to lower production in the U.S., the demand for U.S. goods, production in the U.S., and employment in the U.S. But these things have really nothing to do with employment, really. Those are very transitional. History tells us again and again that trade is not about employment, it's about living standards, it's about raising living standards, and that any costs on employment tend to be very transitional. Okay, now they don't seem so transitional because of the other structural adjustments, because of the cyclical elements, but that's one thing we want to keep in mind. So maybe you want to compare it to productivity accelerations. What happens when everybody wakes up and you're smarter? Well, that means you can produce the same amount of output with fewer workers. Oh, that's a decline in U.S. production. Oh, that's a decline in the demand for U.S. workers. That sounds bad. So you want to avoid increases in productivity? I've got suggestions of how we could do it, okay? But we don't really want to go there, so we don't want to go to protectionism as well with respect to sort of globalization issues. So we don't want to do something that deals with avoiding short-run costs by foregoing long-run gains. But let's dig a little deeper and look at the politics of globalization, understand what's going on here. Surely there are winners and losers, and let's do it this way. You know, some gain, some lose, and the idea is that on net we're better off. And economists have a way of handling this. And the way they would handle this, I'm going to take those three tables over there. You're losers. Sorry. Okay? All the rest of you guys are winners. And here I am, and I got to figure out whether it's good for society. Right? But economists don't have any trouble with that. We use what's called the Pareto principle. We just get a big spreadsheet. We find out how much the winners gain relative to how much the losers lose. And we ask a simple question. Could the winners compensate the losers and still be better off? If the answer is yes, society's better off. I have one question. Losers, does it make you feel better? Oh, okay. I said could. I didn't say do. Okay, that's where the political problems come. There are winners and losers, and the winners don't compensate the losers. Okay? Now, when we have a society that has flexible labor markets, that lives off competition, there are going to be winners and losers. There's an issue of fairness, and there's an issue, too, that if you don't compensate the losers and you don't deal with these issues, there's going to be a backlash that's going to prevent you from realizing all the potential gains. So we want to keep that in mind. Now, in the vernacular of the day, though, we hear a lot of talk about Benedict Arnold firms. So today I want to take another tact on this. I'd like all those Benedict Arnold consumers out there to raise your hands. Okay? How many of you go to the store and buy the best product at the cheapest price you can without even looking where it was produced? I'll be the first. I'll raise my hands. Okay? Oh, we do have a lot of people out there who apparently do. That's very surprising. Okay. So I think I don't have much sympathy for TV commentators or politicians who play the blame game. You know, I taught economics for 27 years. What I teach my students? I taught my students that households maximize satisfaction by allocating their income across goods to get the highest possible satisfaction. I didn't say that they carry out social policy. They run out there to employ certain segments of the population that are disadvantaged, et cetera. No. Consumers don't do social policy. They maximize. And what about firms? We got where we are because we tell firms something very simple. Of course, obey the law. That's a good thing, too. Okay? We tell them go out there and produce goods at the lowest possible cost. That's what we tell them to do. And then they do it, and we start screaming at them. Okay? All right. So I don't have much sympathy for that. Well, let's come back to the economics for a minute. Let's dig a little deeper and ask, why is outsourcing perhaps different? Why is there the angst? And there are some differences relative to other forms of globalization. Now, I saw a quote by Robert Lawrence. He's a professor at Harvard, studied international competitiveness for his entire career. And what he said really took me back a little bit. He said, if foreign countries specialize in high-skilled areas where we have an advantage, we could be worse off. I still have faith in globalization, but it's no more than faith. That's a pretty startling comment by an economist. What could he be thinking? Well, he's, I think, perhaps referring to what we call the terms of trade effect. It's a little subtle point here, but here's the story. When you go from protection to free trade, you're better off. How much better off? That depends on how the price of your exports relative to your price of your imports. The higher your price of exports relative to the imports, the better off you're going to be when you move to free trade. So let's take a situation where the price of our imported goods declines. Let's call them goods produced predominantly with low-skilled workers that are predominant abroad. And trade opens up around the world. The price of these goods goes down. That is very good. Improves the terms of trade. Going to be very good. Going to improve our ability to gain from trade. Now we'll take another experiment. We'll take an experiment in which all of a sudden India is turning out all kinds of engineers and deregulating, becoming more efficient. Trade is opening up, and the price of our export goods declines relative to our import goods. Okay? That means we're worse off than we were before. We're still better off by trade, just the gains from trade have become a little bit smaller. Just to capture this for a minute. Do countries go around saying, I have a weak dollar policy, a weak dollar is good? No, we got Treasury secretaries who've been telling us for some time, we want a strong dollar policy. What's that about? Why is a strong dollar policy good? Because it lowers the price of imports and it raises the real living standards of people in that country. That's why countries want a strong dollar policy. But by the way, doesn't it increase competitive problems in the world? Can't it cost employment? Yes, in the short run it can. But in the long run, it raises living standards. Okay? So keep that in mind. That helps to understand this terms of trade story. Just a couple of other points here. It's also another element is what we call factor price equalization, another important theorem in trade. Wages are converging around the world, and particularly as unskilled workers are becoming more abundant supply, the real incomes of low-skilled workers in advanced countries are declining, and that clearly is one of the factors. Okay, now, I think back to sort of the politics for a second here, what's different about outsourcing is this. Other forms of globalization were basically taking jobs away from more low-skilled blue-collar workers. Okay, so we've got those two tables there. You didn't finish high school. And you're disadvantaged by trade opening up with China and India. And that's a problem, but, you know, there are two things about it. You know, the white-collar and skilled workers might not be having a lot of sympathy, number one. And number two, we know how to solve that problem, education. Well, there's a natural solution, you know, training, education, we know what to do. And now we have another problem over here. You're engineers with master's degrees and PhDs, and your jobs have been offshore. You made all the right decisions. You stayed in school. You finished high school. You finished college. You got a graduate degree. You studied math and science. You did everything right, and you lost your job anyway. Now, we got to keep in mind here that the costs associated with globalization and even productivity in terms of the skill bias, some of them are transitional. People will generally get jobs back, but they won't get the same jobs back. They may get jobs back at lower wages with less benefits. There may be permanent costs. So we've got to make sure this is not just transitional. There are winners and losers, and it's more than short run. It can be sort of permanent. Okay, so just to tick off a few things, we've heard some of the policy issues here. Protectionism, that's a loser. Okay, opening markets abroad, it's a winner, but it's hard work. Okay, adjustment policies, great idea. Okay, have to make them work, though. Okay, retraining, relocation. We have to focus more on how we can use these policies, how we can make them more effective. Maybe public-private partnerships should be part of the story. Education, more generally. There's a skill bias in a lot of globalization and productivity that disadvantages low-skilled workers. We shouldn't be producing as many low-skilled workers as we do. We're actually very good at it. Okay, our education system was supposed to be about equality of opportunity. It's now preserving the status quo. Okay, it's really busted. Okay, and we need to see and change that. What about income redistribution policies? Okay, kind of a dirty word sometimes. But what some of these structural changes do is they skew the income distribution. They make it more unequal. Do we need to worry about that? Encouraging policies that reduce global trade imbalances around the world. The problem today is compounded by the fact that we have such a large current account deficit. Okay, depreciation of the dollar. Helps in that regard, if that's what the markets dictate, that's a positive thing. In addition, policies abroad that raise growth, because part of the reason we have a trade deficit is we grow fast and our other industrial economies, unfortunately, grow very slowly. And general macro policy, a macro policy focused on promoting aggregate demand is especially important at a time like this when there's structural change and pressures. But above all else, we need to maintain our strengths. And what are our strengths? It's our institutions for competition, openness, flexible labor markets. Okay, those are our strengths, and we have to continue to ensure that those stay in place, and also that public policy, which should be another strength, responds to the social problems that arise from private actions. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. We have one other unique perspective to bring to the table. I've asked Lael Brainard, who is the New Century Chair at Brookings and also director of a project there on offshoring the next wave, to share with us the thoughts that might occur to her more readily than many of us, having also been the Deputy Director of the National Economic Council. In that capacity, she has to deal with had to deal in the Clinton administration with views from Congress, with views from the Fed, with views from a variety of government agencies. We are delighted to have her with us today. Lael. I should also add, perhaps, not unlike the Adam Smith story about two businessmen, we've got two economists, each of which have MIT in their backgrounds, and so perhaps one will keep the other honest. Larry?
It's very dangerous. Two economists, three opinions. So.
Well, thanks to Sherm, to Jim, and to Justin. It's a pleasure to be here. I have no idea what I'm going to say that you haven't already heard, but I'll try. Let me start with Sherm's question, which really has to do with sitting in the White House. I think poor Greg Mankiw, it's a pretty bad way to start when you make a comment that most of your economist colleagues would just accept as true on the face of it, and you just unleash a firestorm of public opinion. And I think, to me, that was really more about the president than it was the head of the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. It was sort of like a supermarket scanner moment, similar to what his father must have experienced, where the American people are sort of looking at the White House and saying, you know, don't you feel my pain? And at that moment, I have to say, I was imagining what it would have been like myself to be working in the White House under my boss, President Clinton. He used to read just tons of articles and underline them ferociously and send us notes saying, what are you doing about this? And it would all be underlined. And I could just imagine, starting really in the fall of last year, we would have probably gotten about 100 articles with the what are we doing about this. And we would have had the sort of round-the-clock policy debates about coming up with an agenda that strikes the balance a lot of people have articulated here, trying to preserve the benefits to American dynamism, trying to get the jobs machine back on track, while taking care of people who are clearly being very challenged by the current state of the economy. I don't think I've seen this level of anxiety about America's ability to compete since the Japanese challenge to Detroit. Paul Craig Roberts, a conservative economist, came over to Brookings about 2 months ago and basically pronounced it was the death of comparative advantage and that America is starting on a downward escalator of declining living standards. Well, what's going on? First of all, I think there is this overlay of cyclical and structural. The reality is there is intense anxiety out there about jobs, and it is not made up. It's real. It's in the statistics. If you look at this recovery relative to any previous recovery, there's just jobs gone missing. The Fed did a great study where it saw that the job creation statistics are really where the anomaly is at the moment. Nobody 100% understands what's going on. But the fact pattern is that we're missing, if you compare it to the quote-unquote jobless recovery of 91-92, we're missing about 2.4 million jobs. If you use the productivity rate that prevailed in the latter half of the 90s and superimpose it today, we're missing about 2.7 million jobs. If you look at income, we're missing about $350 billion of wage income. And the other thing that kind of sticks out is that the profit share of GDP is larger relative to any previous recovery. And, of course, the labor compensation share is smaller. So there's a kind of big picture story out there that feeds into this. And then people wake up and they realize that the lure of the 1980s and the 1990s, when they were worried about manufacturing jobs, get a higher degree, go work in higher paid services jobs where America basically is going to just dominate the field, you'll be safe. Turns out nobody's safe in the international economy. It's a fundamentally dynamic place. What I think is interesting right now is two of our speakers have already noticed is we actually don't know very much about what's going on offshoring at all. The data is partly we're not collecting it. The reality is if you look at the services data, for instance, it's lagged, but it's very hard to see any uptick in services imports from India in the categories that we would expect to see if, in fact, there's been an explosion of offshoring. And that's just one of the kind of factual oddities. Goldman Sachs estimates that offshoring's accounted for about 500,000 job losses over the past few years. That's a tiny, tiny fraction by any measure. But that may be the tip of the iceberg. A consulting firm, Forrester, has the most cited statistic out there, 3.3 million jobs over 10 years. That's about 300,000 jobs a year. How does that compare? Well, we lose about 15 million jobs a year due to involuntary layoffs, so maybe 2% of that. Again, maybe not huge. But there's another study out there by some Berkeley economists that suggests 14 million people could be excused for feeling insecure because their jobs are the kinds of jobs that could be at risk, even if they don't lose them. And at the end of the day, I think what is going to turn out to be the real story is it's not really jobs that we're going to be talking about, but what happens to wages. Are we going to see the same kind of pressures on the wage front that we saw during the 1980s when we saw actual real wages going down? And nobody, I think, has the answer on that. It's not clear cut. Are we going to see compression of wage inequality for the first time from above with skilled wages being pressured downward? Are we going to see greater dispersion instead of wages within the services sector? That is one area that that we don't have a lot of good predictions yet. Is this fundamentally different from what we've seen before? No, I think previous speakers have attested to that. It's very similar to the same kind of dynamics we saw, the move from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt, and then move offshore in manufacturing. In fact, a lot of these jobs categories and white-collar professionals in general have also been subjected to a lot of competition from internal outsourcing. Don't forget the financial services back office processing all went first from New York City to New Jersey and then from New Jersey to points out in the Midwest and then started moving offshore. So it is not fundamentally different from that. When was the last time you interacted with a human bank teller, for instance? Productivity and trade are both driving this set of pressures. As Governor Myers pointed out, the real issue here has a lot to do with redistribution and the political system's ability to handle that. Our political system is uniquely bad at dealing with the kind of insecurity that's created by globalization. Let me give you just some numbers from a recent McKinsey report to try to give you a sense of what the redistribution means. McKinsey did a good micro-level study about the kind of value that's created on offshoring. They took just as an example, they took a dollar's worth of labor income, and they said, what happens when that dollar gets offshored? It creates a $1.47 of global value. So there's global wealth creation. 35 cents goes to India. So the U.S. is left with $1.12. We've gained by 12 cents. But then you take the distribution of that, 5 cents of additional exports for the U.S., and 62 cents gets divided between consumers with a little bit more of that going to shareholders. Labor's left with 45 cents. And that, in a nutshell, is the kind of concern. Yes, we're creating value, but it ends up in perhaps different pockets. Now, those are not a good summary of what happens to the economy overall, but I think they're a good snapshot. And the other thing I think to keep in mind is that what we are essentially doing is seeing the integration of two massive labor forces. If you do a thought experiment, India and China were relatively closed economies, and both for reasons that are really internal to them have decided to join the international economy, and they're bringing their labor forces online. Well, the size of their labor forces is pretty remarkable. And so that's what's bringing this pressure. We used to think that that was only going to put pressure on manufacturing workers. Well, guess what? A lot of them are skilled, and more of them are becoming skilled. And so those wage pressures are reaching into a lot more job categories. I have to say I'm with every previous speaker who has said we need to get out ahead on the policy debate. There are things that we can do proactively and we should be doing. And if we don't, we're going to end up playing catch-up to a bunch of very negative Band-Aids. The policy agenda, I think, is actually a very challenging one. Long-term structural challenges. We've got the K-12, the science, math, engineering, education agenda. Somehow we don't seem to be able to really make a difference on that. And yet, it's in terms of longer term, that has to be the answer, along with R&D support from the government, along with some attention to keeping America the most attractive place in the world to do high-value services and manufacturing. And that does go to our tax code. It also goes to health insurance. We have an employer-based health insurance system and a very high-quality health insurance system, which means that our companies employing workers here, it's not just the wage differential, which is already orders of magnitude difference. It's also the benefit structure. In terms of the adjustment agenda, that's the immediate one. That's really all we have to deal with the immediate challenge because these other things are going to take years to actually have an effect. And there I have to say we've just been going backwards over the last few years. We're fighting about extending unemployment insurance, which seems crazy to me. We've actually seen cuts to retraining assistance. And when the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill was brought before Congress 2 years ago, the attempts at that time to include services workers were resisted. And so here we are 2 years later playing catch-up, which seems a bit crazy. And as Congressman Smith said, the fiscal deficit plays into this in two ways. The fiscal deficit bubbles over into an international trade deficit and really gives a lot more intensity to protectionist sentiments. But it also means it's very difficult to pay for some of the things that we need to pay for. And then the last 2 points, I think, have to do with the regulatory issues that Bill Sweeney raised. That is going ultimately to be the area that I think is going to be trickiest to address potential regulatory differences in the markets that we are using to do some of this offshoring without introducing hidden protectionist barriers. And these issues about consumer privacy and cybersecurity are very real ones. And And I think policymakers need to get out ahead, or again, we're going to find legislation like we've seen in some state legislatures, which basically just say that no private medical data can go abroad at all, which basically shuts down offshoring. And the final thing I would say is all of these challenges are extremely important. I hope we have a sensible debate over them this year. In 5 years, we're going to be having a very different debate, and I just want to put it on the radar screen so that you know it's going to turn. In 5 years, we're going to be having a debate about one of the worst skill shortages we've ever seen, because the demographics are actually going to start moving in the other direction, and demographers are forecasting that starting 5 years, and certainly 10 and 20 years out, we are going to be seeing skill shortages of a sort that we didn't even really begin to see in the late 90s. And so this issue about trying to integrate our labor force with international labor forces is going to become absolutely critical to our competitiveness into the longer-term future. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Lael, and thanks to all of the speakers for excellent presentations. Before we take questions from the floor, I'll ask the panelists whether they'd like to ask any questions of each other, I hope. Please.
As long as we have a couple of economists here, I want to take advantage of trying to understand the numbers a little bit better, and the unemployment and the job numbers are, I guess, what has always been confusing to me, because unemployment, as was mentioned, at 5.6% is fairly reasonable. And I guess over the last 10 months, if I'm getting my statistics right, we've added probably about 450,000, 480,000 jobs, if I'm adding it all up. And yet over that time period, the unemployment rate's come down, I think, about a half a percentage point, maybe a little more than that. At the same time, I hear that we need to add 100 to 150,000 jobs a month just to sort of maintain with population growth. How can the unemployment rate be coming down if we're not adding enough jobs to even keep up with population growth? And if there's some statistical anomalies there, it'd just be helpful for me to better understand the situation.
I think Larry has some comments on that.
It's the unemployment rate constant. Okay. If it's falling on average, then we'll need far fewer than that. So that's a possibility, but the fact of the matter is it's a puzzle, and we don't really understand it.
What are those people doing if they're not back in the labor market? Forgive my ignorance here. What does it mean they're not in the labor market?
Well, we have a number of things going on here. Of course, we do have increase in what we'll call discouraged workers, workers who have left, who would prefer to be working but don't feel that the job prospects are inviting enough for them to come back into the labor force. And we have people who are working part-time for economic reasons. I don't see those numbers as unusually high for this unemployment rate, so I don't think that's kind of an issue. But we have particularly young workers, 16 to 25. That's the cohort of workers where we're seeing surprising declines in participation rates. And, of course, one of the things they're doing is they're staying in school longer or going back to school. And, you know, there's a debate about this. Been a lot of discussion really in the last week or two about this issue in a lot of economic commentaries, whether it's just a higher degree of cyclical sensitivity for this particular cohort, and that's what's going on, or there is some secular development. Remember, in a world which is in which skills are more important because of the productivity changes and globalization, maybe it wouldn't be that surprising that the message has gotten through. Okay, and for a while, this may be leading to a decline in those participation rates. It may be that what we need to get employment to grow is a good deal less than 130,000 jobs more.
Let me throw a question out for all the panelists, which is, do you think that this particular round of globalization and changes, is this a qualitative change? Is this different from previous episodes? And I ask that for two reasons. The first is the sort of obvious one, you know, improvements in IT and technological change. Does that make this qualitatively different than previous rounds? The second one is a little more complex, but if you talk to engineers or if you talk to scientists in the high-tech community, they'll say that if you're a user and not a builder, you will lose the ability to innovate. And so one of the things that we see as the U.S. moves out of actually producing some technologies, and particularly in the high-tech area, is a permanent loss of skills. And so does this make this round qualitatively different? And I'd be interested in both the economists and the other panelists.
Bill?
Let me take a stab at that, and I think the answer to that question, Jim, is 5 years from now, because if we take the panel and we're talking about offshoring, the jobs that are moving right now are relatively, many of them are relatively low-skill jobs in the information technology, the call centers, data processing, low-end stuff. But if you will, in the manufacturing world, each step required a significant investment to move up the value chain. We're on an escalator in this. It's not going to require that much more investment. It's going to require to move from low-level writing of software to moving all the way up and being competitive on a world-class basis. In fact, if you look in the software industry or in the information technology industry as far as certifications, you find that Indian firms have made significant investments in certifying themselves according to world-class standards, and right now do have a significant competitive advantage, in my judgment, that they have yet to exercise. So whether or not we see the trend accelerate in this space is how that question is going to be answered. And that, by the way, is U.S. and European and other industrialized countries not making the investments in themselves to be world-class that their competition is doing. If I can just branch to one other point, data in this space is absolutely lousy. We're driven by anecdotes. The data in this area is lousy. The way we collect data is lousy. The way we present data is lousy. And an example of an outsourcing but not an offshoring real-life illustration in the state of Michigan, where EDS has 14,000 people working for it and has world-class customers like General Motors and Delphi and Dow Chemical, we decided to do a little internal track. And one of those companies outsourced their information technology group to EDS. Now, the state of Michigan and the Department of Labor classifies that as a loss of manufacturing jobs from one of those companies, okay? They still haven't found the data to call it an increase in the service sector in the same state, you know, two companies, long-term contracts. And the people were doing information technology for their parent company, and now they work for EDS. But somehow we can't find this simple movement of 30 people from here to here doing the same job, but because their employer is a manufacturer, it's a net loss of manufacturing jobs. Okay, data in this space is awful, folks, and we're driven by anecdotes, and that's dangerous, from my perspective, for policymakers to be so driven by anecdotes.
Can I just pick up on that and ask Congressman Smith if he can share any information with us about the GAO inquiry? How long will it be? What shape is it taking? How confident are you that it's going to help fill this need for data?
I'm pretty confident it'll help. Apparently, we're going to get this back May or June, so we're just waiting for the information. But the real hope is that it will get to the issue of offshoring, most specifically. You know, how many of these jobs were here and are specifically going overseas so we can have a raw number. Because, you know, the Forrester study has been bandied about as fact, and as most of you know, it's not. It's a guesstimate. So hopefully if we can get some statistics. But, yeah, I don't want to overstate it, though. I mean, this is going to always be something that's in constant flux, and being able to track it for, and that's a great example. I will use that for, you know, how it's hard to really keep track of it, no matter how you do it. So it'll help fill in some gaps, but I don't want to overstate it and say that it's going to give us an absolute clear picture.
Chris, you wanted to comment on Jim's question.
Yeah, well, first, I would agree with Bill and with Congressman Smith about the need for data. It is very dangerous to make government policy decisions on the basis of a collection of anecdotes. I would wager, Jim, in answer to your question, that if we went back and looked at the records of think tank panels in the 60s or in the 80s, your same question was probably asked. Is the electronic movement to movement to electronic automation and robotics fundamentally different? I remember reading books about the fundamentally different challenge from Japan. We have faced new challenges before. This is clearly a new challenge. I believe we will be able to face it. Having said that is not to say that we can simply say, relax, everything's fine. I agree with Congressman Smith. That is not the right answer. When someone loses a job, it's not a mathematical equation. It's a human question. And we have to have a set of policy responses to deal with that anxiety, because that anxiety is real. Our view, the administration's view, is that there are a set of policy responses that involve opening markets, enforcing trade agreements, lowering barriers, and providing adjustment assistance, worker retraining, and education to help people respond to the challenges of this new economy. This is a different debate than was had about NAFTA in the early 90s, where each side sort of juggled about this many jobs will be created versus this many jobs will be lost. That's not the kind of debate we should have. We need to acknowledge that for some people, this is a cause of real concern, and we have to have the best policy response we can come up with that keeps markets open and keeps the economy growing.
We have a few minutes for questions or comments from the panel, from the audience, excuse me. We've had a lot from the panel. I had someone, a hand in the back, if I may. Would you stand and identify yourself, and they'll bring a microphone to you.
Thank you. Susan Finston from Pharma. I just wanted to support what Lael was saying. I think that it's the U.S. innovative industries that are really the most important in terms of the kind of job creation where we see high-quality jobs for researchers, for scientists, and the pharmaceutical industry actually leads the world in the creation of new drugs now, because we've had historically strong support in the Congress and the executive branch for innovative industries. And I think that that's the kind of policy that we have to underscore to make sure that we have strong intellectual property protections for pharmaceuticals. And there has been a kind of discouraging lack of understanding of how all these things move together in recent years. And I think less of an understanding than we had in the 80s and the 90s on the value of innovation to the economy and the importance of putting these things together legislatively and through executive policy to support innovative industries like the pharmaceutical industry. But just to add one more statistic, most people don't realize that close to 20% of the research scientists in American laboratories working for pharma members were actually trained in India. So we have actually benefited from the exodus of their labor force before their reforms, as all of us take new drugs. And it isn't just one company or one therapeutic area. Close to 20% of all of our research scientists. That's an unusual statistic, and I think it should tell us that we really do benefit from all of our interactions in the global economy, and that, you know, we don't want those scientists to stop coming to the U.S. We want to continue to have the new drugs that they create, and there's a real value to that relationship.
Thank you very much for that comment. Did anyone on the panel want to comment? Lael?
That's a very interesting statistic. I just wanted to throw out another interesting statistic. I think Craig Barrett, the head of Intel, recently pointed out that the U.S. government right now spends about $5 billion a year on R&D in the physical sciences, which is a minuscule number, as anyone will know when you look at private R&D budgets. And, you know, it's hard not to compare it with what we spend on agriculture subsidies, for instance, which are really not directed towards innovation. They are really more directed towards simple income subsidies. And we have to rethink that. It is not the case, obviously. I think people forget this. The U.S. is not going to do everything better than any other country. We are going to do some things better than any other country. And as to Jim's question as to whether this is qualitatively different, it does remind me a great deal of the debate that we had on semiconductors. What happened was, first we moved over to Southeast Asia, the kind of low-skill assembly operations. But over time, Japan, South Korea, and others actually got better than us at some of the higher-end activities on semiconductors. And here as well, it's not just that these Indian firms are doing things with better labor rates. in some areas, like IT services, they're actually more competitive, and we're going to cede part of that. And what we need to be doing is making sure that our government policies towards R&D and education, innovation generally, are creating those new industries where the very high value is going to be created, so that we're continually moving on the edge of the frontier, but we're not necessarily maintaining advantage in every single existing industry.
You had a question here. Can we bring a microphone up here, please? You stand and speak loudly. I think we'll all hear you.
Greg Woodhead with the AFL-CIO. Thank you very much. And I was really heartened to hear right off the bat that we have winners and losers in trade, and Bill did a great job pointing that out. And then for the other proposition is to have TAA extended for service workers. What do you tell them to train for? It will pay them anywhere near a master's degree job in electrical engineering. They've lost their job. They're out of work for 2 years. So you're going to TAA training for what? So angst is real. Our members beyond the Beltway, and I can't fault them for getting angry and saying we ought to stop all these agreements if this is what you offer us at the end of the day.
Smith?
If I could, first of all, you're right on the TAA, and funding is part of the problem. I mean, it had been mentioned earlier, we worked hard to improve TAA benefits 2 years ago as part of the fast track authority. But, you know, the authorizing has not been matched by the appropriating, and I think that is a significant problem. And as we look to expand it to service sector workers, there is no question that the money needs to be there to expand it. The second part of it that I think is really important is to focus on where the jobs are going to be. And I think there are some areas, certainly health sciences broadly, not just healthcare, but biotech research, as was mentioned earlier, is an excellent opportunity. In the area of energy, developing new alternative sources of energy is something that I think is a growing possibility. And I'm sure there are other areas. And our TAA programs need to respond to that and offer that training to people where the jobs aren't. You mentioned the example of someone with a master's degree in electrical engineering. What do you retrain them for? I mean, I'd be interested to see in statistics, and I could be proven wrong on this, but I would be surprised if there were a lot of people with master's degrees in electrical engineering who are having a hard time finding jobs right now. Right. I know. I still would think that there are some opportunities. In a lot of cases, that may be, you know, in what sector of the economy. And that's a matter of finding not just the skills, but what's the area of specialty. It's not just a matter of knowing math, science, and engineering. It's a matter of, you know, being focused on, like, those two areas that I mentioned where there's going to be jobs. And we need to get better at all of that. And you're right. There are some states that are even worse than mine. They, too, need to get better at that. That came out wrong. Actually, our state's doing fine in this area. But you know, there needs to be opportunity there. But what I hope, as I said in my initial remarks, and in working with the AFL-CIO, I know the frustrations. I hope that the conclusion of this doesn't come to job training's irrelevant, that basically the TAA and these other things aren't helping. They're training people for jobs that don't exist, because I don't think that's true. When done properly and when funded, I think it is helpful. It's not the sole policy answer to what we're dealing with here, but I think those programs are helpful, and I want to make sure we don't undercut support for them. I want to see that increased so that there's more opportunities.
Chris, you wanted to come?
Just a couple of comments. First, I don't think anyone on this panel, and certainly this administration, is not trying to minimize the anxiety that people feel. That anxiety is real. The question is, what do we do about it? I would point out that the unemployment rate, which Congressman Smith asked about earlier, is in fact now lower than the average unemployment rate in the 70s, in the 80s, and in the 90s. If you look at the decade-long averages. The issue, though, is how do we deal with the concerns that people have about where they're going to find the new jobs of the future? And if we can agree to work together and focus our efforts on how to improve the operation of programs like trade adjustment assistance, I think that is one of the constructive policy responses that we can have, that we can hopefully work on in a bipartisan way that will help people. I agree that we have to be careful, again, about these anecdotes. People are using the anecdote that there are all these unemployed PhDs running around or masters. I'm not convinced that the statistics, and I'd be interested in the one you mentioned, Greg, having more info on, that's true. If you look at the kinds of jobs that are being provided now by competition in India or Latin America, they tend to be things like call centers, like people who are processing employee expense vouchers, people who are providing customer support for computers. It's not entirely clear to me that that those are the kinds of jobs that you're talking about with people with that high level of education. But I hope what we can do is agree that let's talk about and have a good, honest debate about constructive policy responses, better use of TAA. Some may argue for higher levels. That's fine. What I've been concerned about is the debate, unfortunately, has sort of reflexively been, let's close the market. Let's put restrictions on. Let's prohibit these kinds of contracts from going forward. We need to overcome that first.
Bill Sweeney and then Lael, and then I'm afraid we'll have to quit.
I just want to put a quick commercial in. Number one, the angst is real. The angst is real among the employed as well as the unemployed. No problem. When EDS has a change in a global company with 130,000 people, 55% employed here in the United States, 47% of our income coming from business we're doing outside the United States, the first thing that we do is look at the people to see if we can either redeploy them or reskill them. And our estimates are that we save between $8 and $10 million a year by being able to redeploy or reskill people. We've had some stellar examples where we've been able to take an entire account, reskill it in another technology, keep everyone employed on another piece of business here in the United States as well as around the world. Now, as an employer, that angst in our business, in every one of the information technology companies, is real because, as I said in my remark, customer is king. And customer can change our directions, our mandates, how they want that service or product delivered. And so it is an ongoing issue within information technology companies among the employees that the job they're doing today, and it's not just India. We have the best shore facilities to help our customers achieve their goals in 15 places around the world, and we have a business presence in 58 countries. So this is an ongoing issue. But the first issue that we address is how do we redeploy and reskill? And the biggest issue that we run into, particularly among people who are established, is they don't want to move. They don't want to get on an airplane. And we ran into this in Y2K in particular, where people just did not want to take on travel demand so as to stay with us. So it's a complex problem. And the real challenge is to all of us is how do you invest in your communities so as to keep the locations, so as to keep the jobs in those communities and the strength of those communities.
Lael.
Yeah, just on this issue, I think the problems with trade adjustment assistance are extremely difficult. They've been with us for some time. The take-up rate, as you said, even since the reforms in 2002, is nothing like what we'd like to see. It's always been sort of the poor cousin of the Department of Labor. Department of Labor doesn't have a lot of passion for it. But the reality is that we have got to make it work because we are in an extremely dynamic global economy. And if we can't get trade adjustment assistance right, we're not going to be able to provide those social safety nets. America does not have anything like the social safety nets that European workers sort of fall into when they lose jobs due to international competition or productivity. Trade adjustment assistance is a sort of half-hearted at this juncture attempt to approximate that. For the first time, healthcare benefits were included in that. That's another critical thing because of the way that our system is employer-based health insurance. It just doesn't seem right that workers should be facing not only the loss of their job, but also the loss of their health insurance, often pension benefits. And the other thing is that we know that workers dislocated to trade on average suffer declines in lifetime earnings. And so that's why for the first time Congress legislated a wage insurance program, which is from a policy point of view, it's a very smart program, but it's only applicable to workers who are over 50, earning under $50,000. Well, guess what? This new class of workers are very likely to be under 50, earning over $50,000, and that's going to cost money, but we have to take that challenge very seriously. And finally, trade adjustment assistance is not the answer to what's going on in the labor market generally. The productivity numbers out there and the job market numbers suggest that we really do need to be worrying more generally about extended unemployment insurance benefits, more generally about retraining. It's not just for trade dislocated workers, it's for dislocated workers generally. And instead what's happened is community college funding has been badly undercut by the state and local fiscal crisis, and we need to fix that.
Please join me in thanking this panel for an excellent discussion.
Thank you so much. Excellent.